go ahead and move on. We'll have Jordan Bell with pre-plant considerations for cotton, sorghum, and corn.
Great. Thanks so much. Well, I'm happy to be here. I do want to point out before I start that I had actually spoken with Pete Dautre, and he's covering pre-plant considerations in cotton, so that will be done later. I'm not touching on that in this morning's program. So what I am going to touch on, though, is planter maintenance as well as some corn hybrid selection. And I know probably many of you are going, well, corn, we don't have the water for corn. But I do know, just in visiting with crop consultants as well as some of the agents and Blaine Reed, who actually scouted for many people in this area this past summer, that because of planting conditions, there was increase in corn acreage last year. So I do think that for some of y'all, it might be important to talk about some corn hybrid considerations. If you do run into another issue where you can't get your cotton in time, what can we do with our corn crop? So, of course, moving right into planter maintenance and why I really think that this is one of the most important things we can talk about today, it's important to keep in mind that the mistakes we make at planting can haunt us all season. It's not uncommon for me to get calls from producers to go out and look at a field, and in many cases, we're putting the blame on the hybrid or the variety, and it really becomes, in our minds, a seed issue, but sometimes it's not that seed issue at all. It actually goes back to the planter and what mistakes we have with the planter that affect that stand. So when we talk about planting, of course, we have the temperature, and that can be a very important consideration. We all know that. We run into, you know, issues with planting. And of course, you know, how does the soil texture affect that? But also soil moisture, seed to soil contact. And we all know that's really important. But if we have some issues with our planter, we're not getting that seed to soil contact. And even if we have good soil moisture and we don't have the seed to soil contact, we're not going to get the germination and we're going to have an issue with our plant stands. Also, planting speeds and then even what population are we considering can really impact that. So with planting maintenance, of course, or planter maintenance, we have that right hybrid. We have the irrigation program, the fertility program, as I mentioned. Well, we could have all that in place, but if our planter's not working properly, that's all for waste. So we really want to be thinking about that. So the first thing I want to touch on when we start talking about our planter are those parallel linkage arms. And it really comes to be something that's very basic. But I think that this is something that we often overlook. We're not out there checking that. We're checking our seed depth. Oftentimes you're paying attention to how your row cleaners are set, paying attention to how those openers are set and your press wheels. But we're not paying attention to what's happening on these linkage arms. And if there's a lot of play in those linkage arms, if your bushings are worn, you're actually going to have that planter riding with the nose down, and that's going to create you some planting problems. Even if you have everything set correctly and it's level, the planter base is level, if there's a lot of play in these linkage arm, your row coulters will not be running correctly. You'll have a row unit that's not level, causing those coulters to run too deep, a lot of errors with your planting depth. Also, that could create some issues with your down pressure. So something to really keep in mind with that. And that could even cause your seed tube to not be properly set. So just keep in mind as you go through and you're thinking about, you know, things to get ready for planting, check the bushings on this and check to see if there's a lot of play. And especially if you lift up that planter body and you push down on that and you can see if there's how the play is on it between your different row units. And it's definitely something that is worth checking and ensuring is set properly. Here's an example of some worn out parallel arms, and then of course here's those new arms, and really a lot of it can just go to the bushing. And so because of prices, everyone's using older equipment, and even in our research equipment we are constantly faced with having to rebuild old equipment to maximize the life out of it. And this is something that in my research that I've felt very strongly about. I'm using very old equipment, but I've made sure every year we go through and really check all the components on these planters to ensure that we do have good plant stands. So also, if we have some play in those parallel linkage arms and it's causing, you know, improper setting with those openers, we can have soil backfilling due to how that's set. And so if you have soil backfilling into your seed trench, well, now you have an issue with improper seeding depth. You have that poor seed-to-soil contact, and you're going to wind up with issues with that. And it's not uncommon to be walking through a field, and all of a sudden you see, especially behind one row unit, you have seed that's riding on the surface. And so that can be very problematic. When we look at a corn crop, If we have one skip or just even just, you know, an issue from one misplaced seed per 100 plants, we can wind up with, on average, it's a 2.5 bushel per acre yield loss. So you think one per 100, well, say you're on limited water and you're planting 24 to 26,000 seeds per acre. Well, you're looking at about 240 missed plants per acre. You know, you easily have 2, 3, 4, 5. You could be easily running into several thousand plants per acre that are off just due to that. Well, what that boils down to, when you think about several thousand plants that, you know, did not come up on time and you have those misses in your field, that's easily $20 or more per acre loss just from a seeding issue. So when we talk about herbicide cost, you seed cost, well, if you have $20 or more lost per acre from a seed planting issue, that's really impactful. And so just definitely something a little bit of time can be beneficial with that. So in addition to, of course, the issues with parallel linkage arms and the bushings and that creating issues with plant establishment, also we need to be checking our seed openers. And, of course, those seed openers are what are opening up that planting furrow. We want to make sure that we have a good, clean planting trench for that seed to drop down into. And so if it's not opening and it's not clean, it can also be allowing soil to backfill into that seed trench, resulting in poor seed-to-soil contact. When we look at those seed openers, it is important to keep in mind that the diameter of the opener is going to vary from planter to planter and with different companies. And so it really, to properly check it, you do need to take that opener off, check the diameter, and make sure that you don't have excessive wear. And when we look at that, it's really not a whole lot of wear that starts to create problems. We're looking at about a half an inch from, if you think about a new disc opener to one that's worn, a half an inch difference. And one quick way to check that before you actually start taking stuff off is actually to run a business card between those two openers under the planter. So lift up your planter, run a business card between those, and it should be a very tight fit. And if it's not, if you have a gap wider than a business card, that's going to allow that soil to backfill into that trench, and you're going to get poor seed-to-soil contact. You're going to have improper placement of that. So also chains. Of course, chains, we see them, we hear them, but chains really can create a big issue, and especially with our seed meter. And it's not uncommon, whether we're talking about a grain crop in corn or sorghum or even a cotton crop, to see doubles. And when you see doubles, you know you have an issue with your metering system. And so if you have a kink in that metering system and it's causing doubles to drop, you know, that the chains are a place where we can very easily go back and check and make sure that all the chains are right. We don't have warns in the chains causing issues with that transmission system on that planter. So when we talk about our seed meters, of course, there's a lot of plastic parts in these seed meters. It doesn't matter what brand of planter you have, there's a lot of plastic parts. And all of our seed anymore has multiple seed treatments on it. And those seed treatments, they really can start to stick to those plastic parts. So that's something else that during an off-season would be very valuable to go in and start looking at. Clean those seed meters out. Make sure you don't have a lot of seed treatments that are building up. Because if you do have stickiness in those within the meter, you can have seed sticking. And that's also going to potentially create some skips. Also, brushes, gaskets, discs, and even, you know, that drum in there. Just making sure all of that is clean. Research from Pioneer has shown that a properly calibrated seed meter can add 6 or more bushels per acre. So that's pretty significant when you start thinking about how that could add up. So just one piece of this that could really be impactful as we start thinking about our pre-plant management decisions that we can make. Also, the seed tube. That seed tube is very important for the placement of the seed in that seed furrow. If you look, pick that up and you actually see where it's been cut, it's, you know, gotten hung up on a chunk of concrete, you know, if you lay manure, it's not uncommon for those seed tubes to get worn very quickly. So you want to make sure that you don't have any tears or dog-eared flaps on the bottom of those so that that seed is dropping where it should in that planting furrow. And then also the closing wheels. That's something on our research planner that I've really noticed over the years can really make a big difference. And because we do plant across a wide range of soil types, It's really been obvious to see how just closing wheels that are not properly set can really make a difference in a good plant stand. So when we talk about our closing wheels, of course, one of the first things to do is actually check those bearings. And when we think about just all the dust, and then even if we're coming in and putting down some side dress fertilizer, as that fertilizer splashes up on those bearings, it is going to start to corrode them. And as those bearings become corroded, those wheels are not going to spin as freely, and they're going to get hung up. And when that does happen, your wheel's going to drag, and as that wheel drags, it's going to push soil into that planting furrow rather than packing it down neatly as it should. And that's going to create issues within that trench and spacing. Of course, ultimately, that furrow, these closing wheels are designed to firm the soil around the seed. We want to maximize seed to soil contact so that we can get germination as quickly as possible. And if this isn't happening correctly, that can create a lot of issues with that. Here's a picture I took from a field, actually this past year. And of course, on one hand, I do know that the field was planted in too wet of moisture. There was an issue with the double disc openers actually packing the planting furrow. And so we can see that, but we also see those closing wheels didn't do anything. It was, or at least in this row, on this row unit, it was not closing that furrow. So there's a lot of things we can do with this just to make sure that those closing wheels are working properly. I do know of many producers who actually like to use a chain behind their closing wheels so that you can actually go in and help cover that up. One of the problems is, though, if you are only relying on a chain, is that you could have a lot of air gaps in there. And if you have air gaps, you don't have that seed-to-soil contact. And especially for corn, corn has to imbibe or absorb 30% of its weight in water before it actually starts that germination process. So if you have air pockets in there, as you know, it's almost like just drilling into or planting into, you know, just dry soil. It's going to take weeks to get that germinated, not just a matter of days. So when we talk about closing wheels, of course, on most of the planters, they do come with a smooth closing wheel, except for the case planters, which have that single wide closing wheel. That closing wheel, the smooth closing wheel, it does work very well when managed properly, but a smooth closing wheel can actually overpack the furrow. So that's something to keep in mind, how you don't want to overpack it either so that you create issues with the germination process. And this can occur under damp conditions, and that ultimately results in poor root penetration into the sidewall as well. Also, spoked tined wheels. So that's something that in many cases I've seen more and more producers using a spoked wheel or a tined wheel, so that can actually help break up the planting furrow. So if you do have issues with your openers going in and packing the sidewall, that spoked or tined wheel can help break that. But that can also, especially if you are in very dry soil, create some issues. So I've seen more and more producers starting to go to these curved tooth. And that actually helps ease the closing wheel up out of the planting wheel as it turns. There's not the risk of actually turning the seed like a straight spoked wheel does. So this actually can be a good option if you do run into issues with cresting. You know, it's not uncommon. We'll go in and we plant, we got everything packed down, and then we get just enough of a rainfall that we have a crust. And so having a spoked or a tined wheel can actually help keep that broken up enough that you don't have as much cresting on that planting furrow. But if you don't want to run into issues also where you disturb the seed, depending upon how you have those set. As I mentioned, the drag chains, here's a picture of a drag chain behind those closing wheels. Those drag chains do help keep that smooth. But again, if you are relying heavily on a drag chain, you could create air pockets within that planting furrow, and that could create some issues as well. One option actually that does work pretty well is having one spiked wheel and one rubber wheel. And so with that, you have the spiked wheel that actually helps keep that broken up, and then that rubber wheel does come in and just pack that and give you that good packing tension that you want. So we've seen that work very well. And especially, of course, even though for the most part we have very uniform soils, but if you're planting a lot of country and you have sandy soils to a tighter clay loam soil, something like this might actually give you some flexibility as you move across those different soil types. with that. In addition to, of course, the smooth wheels, I've actually seen some of the smooth wheels that actually have a ridge. So it, you have, rather than just this smooth surface, there's actually a notch at the bottom of that. And so with that, that ridge actually comes in and helps cut, provide a cut on that surface. So again, if you have a risk of soil crusting, that cut surface actually helps allow that plant to germinate and come up through that. Other issues that we run into, of course, down pressure. Excessive down pressure on the closing wheels can press the seed down, and so then you wind up with an improper seeding depth, and also creates issues with the soil inhibiting the root growth. So you wind up overpacking. So, of course, down pressure is something that we definitely want to check for. So in addition to the down pressure, also, you know, checking our gauge wheels, making sure that those frame bushings aren't worn so that the gauge wheels are set properly and we're getting those the proper depth with that. And of course, as I talk about the closing wheel, I do want to point out that sometimes the issue is not just with the closing wheel itself, but actually how that closing wheel is running over the furrow. And there's been many cases where I've, especially when we're planting large plots and walking behind planters and seeing that seed placement, there might be one row unit, it hit something in a field somewhere and it's just offset. And so you have, rather than those closing wheels riding on top or to the side of the planting furrow and packing uniformly, you actually have one side of that actually pushing down into that planting furrow and disturbing the placement of that seed. Well, if you're on a 16 or 24 row planter and that's repeated across several hundred acres, that becomes very significant. And so with that, you might actually want to go in and check not just the closing wheels, but actually the mounting arms. And again, back to the bushings. You know, are the bushings worn? Has something happened that's causing that to be offset and run down to the side? So that's definitely worth checking. And one of the easiest things to do when we go in and check this, and especially with our research planters at the beginning of the season, I've started to have my crew actually pull that planter across a very smooth surface so that we can actually see if the spacing's properly, and we can see that the down pressure is equal behind all of our row units. So something that really can be important there. You want to make sure that with that closing wheel arm that there's not too much play in that, so that you do not cause issues in that furrow. Now, also our row cleaners. As we see more and more conservation tillage, these row cleaners become more important, especially if we're planting behind a grain crop, and especially for cotton behind a grain crop. With our row cleaners, of course, the objective is to create a clean seedbed, and that also does allow that soil surface to warm more quickly. But if we have improper tension on those row cleaners, we can actually be coming in and creating a furrow ahead of, you know, with that row unit, and we don't want to create a false furrow with that. So definitely important to check how those row cleaners are set. This can also be an issue at faster speeds. And when we look at how aggressive row cleaners can be at faster speeds, you know, we want to make sure that's not an issue. And that actually, if we're talking about planting into damp soil, that can create a big issue with that, because the exposed damp soil will actually clot up on that row cleaner. And as y'all know, before you know it, you get to an end of a row and you have this big mud ball. And so that's, again, going to affect the seed placement. So I do think it's important as we talk about, you know, our pre-plant considerations and things we need to do, and we start looking at different planters. You know, there are some of the high-speed planters that are on the market, and I've seen producers who do not have a high-speed planter out there planting at 12, 13, 14 miles per hour, if not faster. But when we actually look at this, the high-speed planter actually has a mechanical delivery system that actually helps deliver that seed from the seed meter to the seed furrow. And so if we look at our traditional planters that are not a high-speed planter, that do not have that mechanical delivery system, that's where we are not going to have the accuracy with that. So planting speed is very important, and that's something I do know we need to keep in mind. Of course, again, it's easier for me to say this. You know, when you have hundreds and thousands of acres to cover and a very narrow window, you are in a hurry to get that done. But that could potentially cause you a significant loss in plant stand, and of course that impacts your overall productivity of that field. Seed spacing, that also, when we talk about high-speed planters, those mechanical delivery systems in those meters help ensure that we have spacing that is uniform. In our other planters, we wind up with seed spacing issues. As I mentioned, when you see a double, you know, planted side by side, that's an issue from your metering system. And those doubles quickly become, it can quickly become a weed within that field because there's competition. They're not, the productivity is not being maximized in those plants like they would be if they were spaced uniformly. And then, of course, planting into wet soils. And this we saw definitely this past year quite a bit across the region. But even a couple years ago, one of my first experiences with this, I was actually called by a producer to go look at a cornfield up by Groover. And he had planted, and that corn had been in the field for over 6 weeks. And you know, at that point, you know, it still hadn't done much. I mean, he was still looking at a crop that was about 8 to 10 inches and hadn't developed. And his question was, why? And as we dug down, we saw that because of how those openers rode in that wet soil, they packed that sidewall. And this is not a picture from this field. This is actually a picture that I pulled off the internet. But this is exactly what we saw within that field. There was no lateral extension of those roots. The root was just growing down that planting furrow. Of course, in cotton, I know that, you know, we have a tap root and we don't run into this as much. But nevertheless, when you think about the energy needed for that root to actually break through that compaction, it's pretty significant. And so we want to make sure that we don't have sidewall issues from packed seed open or furrow openers creating issues with that. And of course, it's not just the compaction within the planting furrow, but also when we consider just the compaction within the field itself. And wet soils are more prone to compaction at deeper depths than drier soils. So definitely something that's important to keep in mind. So, of course, when we look at, especially in a grain crop, a late emerging plant often becomes a weed. And so here's an example of late ears or ears from late emerged corn plants to normal ears. So definitely very significant. Of course, looking at these ears, there's definitely issues with tip back and pollination issues probably and some other things. But nevertheless, we see that there was a definitely an issue with regards to just the ear development from those later emerged plants. Now, this is actually a picture that I took from some of our research plots a couple of years ago. And when we start looking at the issue with poorly emerged plants and planter issues, you know, we definitely see what's going on above ground. We see the delayed development in the plant, the maturity that's delayed. But often we do not pay enough attention to what's going on below the soil surface. And so if plants are not uniform above ground, plants are not going to be uniform below ground. And those roots are so important to for the yield potential of that plant. So we see an example of, you know, a root system where we had good fibrous root development and it was a lot of root activity. Whereas here's this delayed plant and we do not have that root activity. So again, just keep in mind, if you have a good uniform field, you're going to have good uniform root systems and you're going to be maximizing that nutrient and root water uptake. As I mentioned, planting speed, how important that is with regards to your seed metering system. And if you do not maintain a proper planting speed, you're going to wind up with issues. Well, there's actually some research that had been done in the upper Midwest on the effect of planting speed on yield in corn. A Purdue study found that a decrease in yield from 2 to 5 bushels per acre per mile per hour speed increase at 50% of their test sites. So on one hand, you go, you know, 2 to 4 bushels per acre. Well, that's not much. But per mile per hour, you know, if you should be planting at 7 miles per hour and you're actually out there planting at 12 to 14 miles per hour, well, that could potentially be a 12 to 15 bushel per acre reduction in yield depending on field conditions. So it is an extreme example, but nevertheless an example of the impact that that can make. A study in Wisconsin showed a very similar result. They had a 1.8 bushel per mile per hour decrease due to increase due to a change in speed from 8 miles per hour to 4 miles per hour. So that's definitely pretty significant. And of course, the effects of speed increase on rough ground. And that is why I do think it's a bigger issue in this region, because we are often planning into dry conditions. And in those dry, rough conditions, especially if it's cloddy, you know, we're not getting the seed-to-soil contact and everything that I previously discussed. So with that, I'm going to jump over to corn hybrid selection. And especially as we start looking at corn hybrids and water-limited environments, there are definitely some considerations that we can make to help ensure production in water-limited environments. Of course, the first thing I want to point out is corn uses a lot of water, and that's not news to anybody in this room. When we look at the maximum water use for a corn crop in a normal year, we're looking at 35 hundredths of an inch per day, and that's going to be at tasseling. And that's not necessarily what's so impactful. What's impactful about a corn crop is that we're using more than 3/10 of an inch per water for more than a 2-month period. We're going from 12 leaf to blister. So that's a very wide part of that production season where we're using quite a bit of water. And so as we think about this, knowing how much water that corn crop's going to use, we need to keep in mind how this impacts our water plan as well as our hybrid selection. Of course, with our water plan, the first thing we need to know is what really is our well capacity. When we look at meeting the peak water requirement of 3/10 to 35 hundredths of an inch per day, if we're operating at 90% efficiency, we need a well capacity of 6 to 7 gallons per minute per acre. And very few producers have that kind of well capacity anymore, even if there are several wells tied together. So in reality, we're operating down in this 3 to 4 gallon per acre range, if not lower. And so it really becomes, when we're trying to grow a crop in that 3 to 4 gallon per minute per acre range, what can we do with hybrid selection to maximize the productivity? Now, this is some data that I had from Bushland. It is 2010, so even though it's 10-year-old data, it's what would be representative of a normal year. And I think we can probably all agree that we very rarely have a normal year anymore. We are producing crops in an area of just extreme weather events. But in a normal year, if we're trying to meet this 3/10 of an inch crop water requirement, as I mentioned, we need 6.3 gallons per minute per acre. But our bank right here, this stored soil water, is what's really going to help us make that productivity. If we have 2 inches of stored soil water, we can get by with a 4 gallon per minute per acre well. Now, of course, that's going to vary depending on your soil texture. In a clay loam soil, we actually can have 2 inches of stored soil water within that first foot. If we're in a coarser textured soil, you know, we probably only have a 1/2 inch of water in that top foot. So it really does impact how we're managing our irrigation timing and, you know, how we're making these cropping decisions, and especially even what we do with planting populations, especially in a corn crop. The one thing that I saw this year, and it wasn't just things that I saw, but also in visiting with Blaine Reed, he saw it, and he saw it down in this region too, and especially in Hale and Floyd County, were issues with rooting depth. And so what we had very wet conditions at planting, which was great. And all across the panhandle, especially where producers were not able to get their cotton crop in, it's like, well, you know what? We might not have the water for the corn anymore, but let's go with it. You know, we probably are setting up for a good corn year. And there are producers in the northern panhandle who were yielding anywhere from 150 to 170 bushels per acre with this year's corn crop. And they're like, what happened? You know, considering the water they had, it was a very big surprise. So one of the things that, of course, as I mentioned, rooting issues. And this is actually some corn that was from a field over here in Hale County. And going out to this field, initially the producer was, you know, concerned, couldn't figure out why it burnt up so quickly. Of course, it got very hot and dry in July and August. And so he knew that he didn't necessarily have the full well capacity to meet the crop water demand for, you know, peak production, but nevertheless, it shouldn't have dried up as quickly as it did. And so digging down, we saw these very shallow roots, and it had actually probably only rooted about 1.5 feet. And so again, thinking back to that soil water volume that we're able to access, because he had initiated his irrigation very early in the season with the early season precipitation. He kept that soil very wet. And roots are very lazy. There's no need for those roots to grow down deep to access deeper water as long as conditions are good within that that initial root zone. And so that's what happened. July and August came along. He didn't have the well capacity to keep up, and the crop burn up. But that wasn't just there. That was in our research plots at Bushland. We had the exact same issue, and I'm going to talk about some of that data. And that was all the way up into the northern panhandle. So a very common issue. So as we consider things like this, what hybrid selection decisions can we make to maximize production with limited water? Of course, when we start talking about corn hybrid traits, we really, one of the first things we look at is the maturity class of that corn crop. And so it is important to keep in mind that our total water use does not change with maturity. Our total water use changes, not our daily water use. So again, when we talk about peak water use and maximizing production, we are still, even in a short season variety, we're still going to have that 0.3 inch water requirement per day. It's just that total seasonal water use that does vary. Also, drought tolerance. Again, drought tolerance does not always mean that plant is going to use less water. And I'll talk about that some more. Ear flex, leaf orientation, aggressive silking, as well as stay green traits. So corn maturity classes. Of course, longer season hybrids, I also want to point out, in addition to thinking about the water use, although they may have a greater yield potential, the final production potential is going to be a function of the agronomic traits of that plant, but also the management. So we often see that a longer maturity class does not necessarily out-yield an earlier season hybrid, but your seasonal water use is going to increase. Now, when we talk about, of course, within the Corn Belt, and we look at corn hybrids for this region, in the Corn Belt, there is a greater concern about relative maturity as related to growing degree days. This region, we are not a growing degree day region, or growing degree day limited region with regards to corn production. Now, growing degree days in corn are just like growing degree days in cotton, except for the fact they are calculated on a 50 degree base. But nevertheless, it still is the heat and that's going to drive the development of that corn plant, just like it does in our cotton plant. But we just often don't think about that because we are not a growing degree day limited region within for our corn. But nevertheless, we still have those production related challenges, and they're even greater here, the water as well as the heat challenges. Now, as we break down those maturity classes, an early maturing corn hybrid is going to be one that's an 85 to 100 day hybrid. It needs about 2,100 to 2,400 growing degree days. A mid-maturing hybrid is one that's 101 to 130 days. Now, even though we often classify hybrids that are 150 to 120-day hybrids as a long-maturing hybrid, technically that would fall into a mid-maturing hybrid. I do know that, 30 years ago or more, producers more commonly planted these 130-day hybrids, but we've seen that because of the water use associated with that, as well as the narrowing of the yield gap between the full and the mid-maturing hybrids, it's really not in anyone's best interest to go with a hybrid that long. And this is just a plot from Pioneer actually showing the relationship between the relative maturity class and the growing degree day accumulation that is associated with that. Now, as I mentioned previously, I said that this region is not a growing degree day limited region for corn production, but I do know of several producers who did run into issues later in the season this year with that freeze in October. And it was because, that crop had not fully dried down. We had not accumulated enough growing degree days to get it out in time. So they still had corn that was sitting in the field at 25 to 27% grain moisture, and they could not get it out before that freeze came in, so it wind up having to sit in the field longer than anticipated. When we start talking about heat tolerance, I think it's very important that we keep in mind that drought tolerance and heat tolerance are not synonymous. And that's something that often we do think, well, if a hybrid's going to be drought tolerant, it's also going to be heat tolerant. But those are two separate issues. When we actually talk about heat tolerance, generally we're talking about hybrids that are going to be less sensitive to heat during that pollination period. And of course, that's going to be the silking and the tasseling period. And that's going to be extremely important because if you have a hybrid that is not heat tolerant, those silks are going to be much more susceptible to dehydration. They're going to dry out, and those silks are the pollen tubes for that corn ear. That's actually where the pollen is going down and actually pollinating those ovules, and you're getting your kernels. And if they dry out, and if they're damaged by the heat, well, then you're not going to have the transmission of the pollen down to those ovules and actually fertilize that. So keep in mind that drought tolerance and heat tolerance are not the same. Kernel integrity. This is something that's really important, and I would say that after 2017, something that is even more important. When we start talking about limited water scenarios and actually looking at those earlier maturing hybrids, kernel integrity can actually become a very big consideration. With an earlier maturing hybrid, especially if we plant in late April or early May, they are going to be drying down in August. And during that period in August, the pericarp on our feed corn that we're growing is more prone to rupturing and splitting. And so there's a pathologist in Corpus Christi, Gary Oddbody, who's actually done quite a bit of research over the years looking at the effect of plant diseases, and specifically the fusarium and the fumonisin issues that we saw with regards to the kernel integrity and the splitting of that. So that rapid drying of the kernel surface actually makes that corn more susceptible to disease and to fungal development, and so you could create some big issues for yourself. So if we start looking actually at these early maturing hybrids, I think we need to keep in mind when that crop is going to be drying down. And if you are considering an early maturing hybrid on limited water, think about a later planting date. So you have that crop drying down during a more favorable time, and you don't run into issues with kernel integrity. Now, every year we're not going to have issues with fungal development, but nevertheless, you are discounted for broken grain and for issues like that. So you still don't want that grain cracking and breaking and being more susceptible to damage as you're combining it. So keep maturity class and kernel integrity in mind as you make a hybrid selection. So, of course, positioning corn hybrids in population to available water. Many corn hybrids are marketed as a racehorse hybrid, and ultimately that's what we all want. We all want that upper end yield potential. We want the hybrid that fits into this racehorse environment. But we are talking about a hybrid that has the yield potential with high fertility and high water. And so we need to keep in mind, what is our growing environment? Do we really have the production system for that racehorse environment to really thrive? Or should we maybe be considering a hybrid that fits our environment? Of course, with these racehorse hybrids, you also have upright leaves and a determinant ear to push that population. And when we think about planting on low water, we are planting a reduced population. And if you have a hybrid that has upright leaves, you're not going to get the canopy closure during the season to minimize the evaporative losses from the soil surface, as well as maximize photosynthetic and activity and light capture. So this is not necessarily the type of hybrid we want. So keep in mind, when you start looking at seed placement and someone's selling a racehorse hybrid, that might not necessarily be the hybrid for this production environment. We are in this drought environment. We want a hybrid that has a pendulum leaf, a leaf that is going to provide us that canopy closure. And of course, also with these lower populations, you know, these are the ones that are going to have that flex ear, an ear that has the ability to maximize if we do get the in-season precipitation and can really benefit us under the right environment. And then, of course, we also tend to have variable soils. It's not uncommon, you know, for these cornfields to have a ply lake right down through the middle of them. And so with a lot of these flex ears, it also has the ability to flex with those variable soil textures. When we talk about drought-tolerant hybrids, there are three drought-tolerant traits that are on the market. We have Aquamax from Pioneer, we have Drought Guard from Monsanto, and we have Artesian from Syngenta. And they all can be very beneficial and offer us some beneficial traits. With the Aquamax from Pioneer, those are native traits. It does have enhanced stay green for deeper kernel set, and I'll talk about that trait in more detail. Aggressive silking, so that you do really enhance the synchronization of tasseling and pollen drop shed and pollination, and then also stomatal regulation. When we talk about grain sorghum, of course, we all know that that stomatal regulation and the ability is one of the traits that provides sorghum the ability to withstand hot, dry conditions. And so these hybrids are also marketed to have that increased stomatal regulation as well. Drought Guard from Monsanto is actually a combination of native traits and transgenic traits. And so with that transgenic trait, it's actually what is called a cold shock protein. And that protein is actually marketed to prevent the plant cells from cavitating under water stress. And so, of course, you know under water stress, you see plants starting to wilt. And when those plants start to wilt, those plant cells are starting to cavitate under that water stress. Well, what this protein is supposed to do is help keep those cells turgid so that they don't cavitate and you do not get the wilting. So that does provide the plant the ability to recover under favorable conditions. And then also, just like I mentioned earlier, with regards to maturity class, the temporal pattern of water use can vary, not the seasonal water use. And so with this, they market this as ensuring the plant reaches flowering in a favorable soil moisture, or under favorable soil moisture. So with this, when we think about that, again, you know, keep in mind, it helps the plant withstand a period of water stress within the season. Not season-long water stress, just a period of water stress that within that season so that the plant can recover later on. And then there's Artesian from Syngenta. Those are also native traits. They also have enhanced stay green for deeper kernel set, aggressive silking, and a robust root system. You know, again, back to the value of that root system to capture that stored soil water and even deeper nutrients. So just looking at the difference between fixed ears, flex ears, the fixed ear or a determinant ear, the ear size doesn't change. So if you want to maximize yield with that, you really do need to maximize your population. And with the flex ears, those are ears that will tend to flex depending upon the growing season condition. But you need to keep in mind that flex is occurring very early in the season. When we are determining the size of our corn ear, we're actually in a period from V5 to V12. And often at V5, we're not thinking about the ear size actually being determined. And so that's when that flex is occurring. If you have good conditions, you can be setting yourself up to have a really good ear size. But if you have bad conditions, well, that ear size is going to naturally stay smaller and trying to, you know, with to conserve the resources and not to overuse them. So it is an early season trait. As I mentioned, the leaf orientation, that's something to keep in mind. So if you're in a water-limited environment, ask your seed dealer about the leaf orientation. Is it a hybrid that tends to grow more upright, or is it a hybrid that does that pendulum leaf, which is what you want in your limited water environment? And then silking. When we talk about water stress actually delays silking in a corn plant. And so you want to make sure that the pollination drop or the pollen drop shed from the tassel occurs simultaneously with the silking in that. But if you have water stress, and I don't know if y'all have been out in fields where you've seen water stress during this period, you'll have tasseling occur several days before those silks actually emerge. And so then you wind up with very poor pollination. And so that's something to keep in mind. Now, we also don't want to confuse aggressive silking with unusually long silks. And this is actually a picture I took in our research blocks a couple years ago, and it was pretty amazing to see. It seemed like by the day, those silks just kept on growing. And silks actually can grow an inch to 2 inches per day. So, you know, under very cool, wet conditions, those silks are just going to continue to grow until that pollen shed occurs. So that's just something unique that happens in the corn crop sometimes. Now, as I mentioned, stay green trait and how that can actually enhance the kernel set, especially under water-limited conditions. It increases the duration of grain filling, gives us a greater test weight. And, of course, test weight's a pretty important component of our yield. So this is something that really, if managed properly, can help enhance productivity. Now, for kernel number to enhance yield, you must have adequate kernel filling. And so that is that's what that stay green trait does. Now, of course, when we talk about the ability for that stay green trait to actually be maximized, we need to keep in mind that we're actually talking about for pollinated kernels. When we see tipbacks sometimes, oftentimes we have kernels at the top that were not pollinated or fertilized. Then we also have kernels that were aborted. And so this is where that stay green trait's supposed to help come in. It's supposed to help ensure that these kernels that would have been aborted actually did grain fill. And so that's a benefit to that. Now, in order to actually enhance our stay green trait, we need to make sure we're managing our nitrogen properly. Green leaves need nitrogen. So just like that trait says, stay green, that plant is supposed to stay green longer throughout that production period. It's not supposed to senesce and start drying down as early as non-stay green hybrids. But in order for this to happen, you do need nitrogen. Nitrogen-deficient plants are not going to utilize that stay green trait. And of course, also with regards to fertility, it definitely water does help enhance this as well. But when we think about our fertilizer management program, how are you managing that program? Are we about out of time? Okay. I think it's important to keep in mind how we're making these splits. Do we have everything up front, or are we actually splitting it through the season? And we have seen, even in our research program, that if we actually split that nitrogen out through several application across the season, we enhance the stay green. We also enhance the nitrogen use efficiency. And in many cases, we can actually reduce the amount of nitrogen that is being used in season. And when you talk about just the cost of production, if you can reduce your nitrogen by a couple of tenths of a pound per acre, that over lots of acreage can be very impactful. So real quickly, I'm just going to just quickly touch on some of the research am I completely out of time? Some that we had from our corn crop this past year at Bushland, and that was sponsored by Texas Corn Board. And I just want to show you the response to planting date as well as hybrid and irrigation timing. So going up this graph from the left, we actually have we had two planting dates. We had a mid-May planting date, May the 15th, and we had a mid-June planting date. Now, I know many of you are going to say, well, I'm not interested in a mid-June planting date because of insurance purposes. But if you do plant in mid-June, you can still take out hail insurance. It's not full coverage, but it's really impressive to see year after year what that later planting date does with regards to water use efficiency, and even crop productivity in water-limited environments. So this is planting date one, 50% ET, planting date 2, 50% ET. So just changing our planting date or extending it a month, we went up 20 bushels per acre. Planting date 1, 75% ET, planting date 2, 75% ET, planting date 1, 100% ET, planting date 2, 100% ET. So that's pretty significant when we think about that. Now, this right in here, the 75% ET, this would be that 4 gallon per minute per acre production ground that's becoming more common for our corn crop. Now, when we look at our water that was used, our irrigation plus our precipitation, the latest planted crop in mid-June that had the highest yield actually had the same seasonal water use that the early planted mid-May had. So again, when we think about just water use efficiency, we're in production, we are actually maximizing productivity per inch of water with that later planting date. With regards to the drought-tolerant hybrids, one of the things that we did see, we had early season hybrids and what would be a mid-season hybrid, 98 and 113-day hybrids. We also had two Aquamax, and that would be the blue bar and the gray bar. What we saw is that we did not have any yield difference with regards to that Aquamax trait under this scenario. So again, when managed properly, you know, that those drought-tolerant traits don't always provide that same benefit. And we saw that all across all across the board. And of course, though, I still look at this and I go, our yields were still pretty bad. I mean, we're sitting here at 160 bushels per acre with what was our 100% ET treatment this past year. And it did go back to shallow rooted corn. We had very wet conditions. We initiated our irrigation early. We kept those root systems very shallow. And so, as I mentioned earlier, roots are very lazy. And also, we had stress in season. So because the roots were shallow, when we got to July and August, we didn't have the well capacity to keep up with the crop water demand. And we wound up with a lot of aborted ovules and yield loss. We also had short ears because, again, when those ears were developing, we didn't have that robust root system to really maximize resources. So we had a lot of short ears. And you can see that when you don't have a lot of tip back, that we just did not maximize the potential for those ears. And this was an example I pulled off the internet. It wasn't from our field, but nevertheless, this is exactly what happened. Very shallow root system, which is representative of these root systems from Hale County. Very short ears. That's what hit our yield. If you can really manage your field to maximize your root system and even your planting depth, you can increase the fibrous root development, your nodal root development, and really maximize your ear size and maximize your productivity. So in summary, planter maintenance, I really do think, is key for any crop we're planting. And then, of course, if we're planting corn on limited water, what hybrid considerations are you making? What are those traits?